Sounds True presents Robert Anton Wilson Explains Everything, or Old Bob Exposes His Ignorance, Session 4, Politics and Conspiracy Theory.
You fearlessly adopted some of the most bizarre positions on almost every topic. So
I have?
See,
I thought all my positions were perfect common sense and the rest of the world was weird.
Be that as it may, how have you settled on libertarianism as being closest to something that is meaningful for you?
Well, I will quote three American presidents, the first three. George Washington said, "Government is not reason, it is not persuasion, it is force. Like fire, it is a treacherous servant and a dangerous master." And I think any contemplation of political history will show that government seldom remains a treacherous servant. It very rapidly becomes a dangerous master. John Adams said, "Power wherever invested, whether in a single monarch, an oligarchy, or the majority of a democratic parliament, is always despotic, arbitrary, diabolical, and in every respect dangerous." He was the second president. The third president, Thomas Jefferson, said, "The best government is the least government." So you see, there's nothing really radical or original about my thinking. I got the first three presidents on my side.
So if these aphorisms are true, then why not anarchy?
Why not indeed? Henry David Thoreau pointed out, when Jefferson said the best government is the least government, the logical deduction is the least government is no government at all, so why don't we try that? Jefferson had similar sentiments at least once in one of his letters. He wrote, "If the democratic experiment fails," I'm paraphrasing, of course, my memory isn't letter perfect, "if the democratic experiment fails, I don't think we should move in the direction of European monarchism. We should rather see how well we can adopt the anarchism of our native Indian population." So Jefferson was not too hostile to anarchy. Ralph Waldo Emerson pointed out that during the Revolutionary War, Massachusetts was in anarchy. There was no government at all. And yet everybody was acting cooperatively and friendly and neighborly fashion to kill as many Englishmen as they could. But it was a total anarchy. There was no government at all. And yet people weren't robbing one another's houses or raping one another's women or anything like that. Now I got Emerson on my side, too. My God, then there's Friedrich Nietzsche. "The state, everything it has stolen. It even bites with stolen teeth."
Can you explain the term SOG?
SOG stands for the Czarist Occupation Government, which is what we've got now. They're in charge of the piss police and all sorts of other spies, snoops, and informers. Well, no European can believe it. The only thing you can compare to the United States today is the world you find in the great Russian novels of the 19th century under the last czars. The voters of California, in their wisdom and charity, a couple of years ago voted to legalize marijuana for medical use in a variety of specified cases, including cancer, AIDS, musculosclerosis, post-polio syndrome, and two or three others. And this came about because of the initiative process, which was introduced at the end of the 19th century, when a lot of pretty smart people began to realize that the federal government was no longer representing the people, it was representing the millionaire class only. And as an attempt to make the system more democratic, the initiative was introduced. It was declared constitutional by the Supreme Court, and it's been upheld by the Supreme Court repeatedly. And through the initiative process, the people can pass their own laws and counteract the influence that big money has on politicians. So we got this wonderful initiative process that looked like it was going to restore democracy. Then we passed an initiative that the SOG didn't like, the Czarist Occupation Government in Washington. So what did they do? Clinton comes on television and announces, "Fuck you, you can't make your own laws. We make the laws, you just obey them." And the whole initiative process has been completely abolished after 100 years of making steps. And most of the states that have the initiative, really progressive, think changes have come about through the initiative. Now the initiative doesn't mean anything anymore. The president can just cancel it and appoint a czar to make sure we got to obey the czarist rules and we can't make our own laws anymore. power ever vested, just to be diabolical and in every respect dangerous, to quote John Adams, or it is a fearful master, to quote George Washington again. Peter McWilliams, who died recently because they took away his pot, he was a cancer AIDS patient who, due to chemotherapy, spent most of his time vomiting until he discovered that marijuana controlled the vomiting. And under Proposition 215, the initiative passed by the voters of California, he had a legal right to the marijuana. So he started growing marijuana plants in his yard, and he was growing quite a few of them because he wanted to distribute it to other sufferers from those diseases. And he also wanted to find which strains were best for which purposes, which are best for controlling nausea, which was his problem, which are best for controlling pain, which is the problem with a lot of people, with musculosclerosis and post-polio, etc. They busted him, and the judge forbade Pete Williams' lawyer to say in court that the voters of California had voted to give him the right to use marijuana to treat his illness. They couldn't even mention that to the jury. If the jury didn't know it, they didn't find it out in the courtroom. That was not considered a legitimate defense. The people have no rights anymore. The SOG decides for us. We just obey. The judge had to meditate a long time on the sentence because Peter was going to die in a year or two anyway, so any sentence would amount to a death sentence. But judges have to do things according to the rules. We had to read parole reports and all sorts of reports, this and that, and meditate deeply on how many years are you going to give this guy in prison, a prison hospital, and in the 1 or 2 years he had left of life. And during that time, while the judge was meditating, he forbade Peter to use the marijuana anymore to control the nausea. So Peter went back to vomiting all day long in the bathroom, and he finally choked on his own vomit and died. And when I tell people we got a czarist government, they look at me like I'm a little bit peculiar. All they got to do is read a novel by Dostoevsky or Turgenev, and they'll see the government we've got right now is the government the Russians had in the 19th century.
Well, what about, like, for example, the fact that our government is elected and the czars were never elected? It seems like a pretty big difference.
Yeah, it sure does, until you look at the matter a little more closely. Jim Hightower, who was a Democratic politician until a few years ago, now he's in the Green Party. He has published a list of about 30 corporations that have each donated $500,000 to both Gore and Bush. So both Gore and Bush owe about $30 million to big corporations before they get elected. This is to finance their campaigns. It costs well over $100 million to run a campaign for president now. I don't know how much. It was $100 million in the 80s. By now, it's probably up to $300 million. Anyway, a large part of this comes from all the major corporations. So whichever one of them gets elected, they're in the bag to these big corporations already. They wouldn't even get to the convention if they didn't have that money from those big corporations. So what we got is what the Honorable Senator Pettigrew said when he resigned from the Senate in 1898, a government of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations. And Lincoln's dream of a government of the people, by the people, for the people is a noble dream, and I'd love to see it realized. But we don't have anything remotely like that. When the people can't even make their own laws through the initiative process anymore, the last straw of democracy has been destroyed.
Now, you say the ideals have been lost, or the ideas in the Declaration of Independence. Do you think that freedom in America compares unfavorably to, say, freedom 40 or 50 years ago?
Oh, very definitely. 40 or 50 years ago, even at the height of the McCarthy era, I think if Joe McCarthy got on television and said, I have a urine test for communism and I want everybody to give urine samples where they work so we can find the communists, that would have been the end of his career. The idea of forcing Americans to empty the contents of their bladder to government inspectors. Even Kafka never came up with a satire on totalitarianism as absurd as that. Now the American people have been so conditioned to czarist-type government for so long that, yeah, sure, we'll give you a urine sample. Do you want a hair sample? Do you want a blood sample? Do you want my fingerprints? Somebody wrote a book with this title, A Nation of Sheep. They'll accept any crap the government hands them. And if you quote the Constitution at them, they think you're a red. Or worse.
You've been involved in the civil rights movement since at least the early 60s. Can you talk about what that was like and what you're continuing to do today?
I was the only time I ever got busted. after a life of subversive activities and thought crime and heresy of all sorts, I got busted for trespassing in a barber shop.
How did that occur?
Well, we were trying to persuade the barber to desegregate, and he didn't want to desegregate, and so we had a series of sit-ins, and I got busted in one of the sit-ins.
This was Ohio?
Yeah, Yellow Springs, Ohio. It's a very interesting feeling when you're under arrest. It's just like when you get drafted, you suddenly realize your body doesn't belong to you, it belongs to the government. They can do anything they want with you now that you're under arrest. As a matter of fact, if one of them wanted to pull out a gun and shoot me, probably three of the others would swear in court that I was resisting arrest. Happens all the time, a regular practice. It's a really creepy feeling. I think I was a philosophical anarchist before I was arrested, and after I was arrested, I was an emotional anarchist.
What do you perceive as the greatest threat to our freedom?
The stupidity of the population. As Schiller said, against stupidity, the gods themselves contend in vain.
Do you feel that the American population is more stupid in some way than any other population? Or?
Well, in lots of ways. In Europe, the owners, the capitalists, the entrepreneurs, the managers, they all believe the more intelligent the workers, the better their work will be. So they believe in giving good educations even to the working class. In this country, the capitalists seem to believe the stupider the population is, the easier it is to manipulate them. So why waste time in trying to educate them? And there's been a deliberate dumbing down since the 60s. Every decade, I see more college graduates who don't seem to know. They don't know anything. They don't even suspect anything. Fortunately, Internet is working in the opposite direction.
I wanted to ask you about that. You know, many people claim that technology is going to, you know, especially the Internet and computers, are going to be used to enslave us in some horrible way. And you hear an equal number of people arguing just the opposite, that it's bringing about all these new types of freedom or new vistas of freedom. How do you feel about that?
Well, to take it by a curious path, when I was working on my historical novels, my wife used to collect old encyclopedias. Every time she was in a bookstore, they had a set of old encyclopedias, she'd buy it. So we had about 8 different sets of encyclopedias in the house. So every time I wanted to look up a historical detail, I'd look it up in 3 or 4 of the encyclopedias, and always it didn't take as much as 3. Usually only 2 I'd find a disagreement. If I went through all 8 encyclopedias, I'd find 8 different. Like, how old was Mozart when he wrote his first symphony? He was either 7 or 8, depending on which encyclopedia you look in. How tall was the Bastille? 90 feet, 100 feet, or 120 feet, according to 3 encyclopedias I consulted. This is what provoked me to what I call Wilson's 22nd law. Certitude belongs exclusively to those who only own 1 encyclopedia. If you own more than 1, you begin to encounter a certain amount of doubt and uncertainty about things in general. More and more people are doing research on Internet. I wrote an article a few months ago in which I didn't open a single book. All the research I had to do, I did on the web, on the world. Everything I wanted was on the World Wide Web. That certainly wasn't true 10 years ago when I first got online. I did a whole article without once leaving the computer. Everything I wanted to look up, I just go to the World Wide Web and I could find it pretty fast. So more and more people are doing research on the web. And the one thing you find out when you do research on the web is what you find out if you own 8 encyclopedias, which is that there's no one reliable source. There are a dozen different sources all claiming to be reliable. And then you've got to use your own ingenious mind and your own talent for analysis and skepticism to try to figure out which one of these guys really sounds like he might know what he's talking about, or which one should I bet on. Husserl says every act of perception should be regarded as a gamble. And from the experiments I've done and the experiments I've led in my workshops and seminars, that has become overwhelmingly obvious and true to me. Every perception is a gamble. Just think, you're walking down the street in a big city, you see a face half a block away, and you think it's a friend of yours. You get a little closer, it's a total stranger. All perception operates on gambles. You pick up a few details, you fill in the rest, and if the guy never comes any closer, you're not sure whether you saw an old friend or somebody who just looked a little bit like an old friend.
How does that relate directly to our political freedom, though?
The main trouble with Marxist parties is they think the Das Kapital has all the answers in it. The major problem with the United States is that about 50% of the population at least thinks the Bible has all the answers in it. And then there are libertarians who think Ludwig von Mises has all the answers, except for the ones who think Ayn Rand has all the answers. If you think there's one book that has the answers, you're never going to really discover anything, and you're never going to think an original thought. If you find out there's 12 books with different answers, you're almost forced to start thinking. So I feel Internet is forcing more and more people to do something they've never done in their lives before, which is try to make an independent judgment, how to judge between alternatives.
We've mainly been talking about American politics. What about world politics right now? How do you see that going?
Well, I think the East-West conflict is being replaced by a North-South conflict. I think more and more the darker parts of the globe are struggling to become more independent of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the whole complex that Bucky Fuller calls MMAO, Machiavelli, Mafia, Atoms, and Oil. As a matter of fact, Michio Kaku, the physicist, he said he quit working for the government when he discovered that most of the Star Wars technology was aimed at third world countries and not at the Soviet Union at all. That the United States already figured they had the Soviet Union buffalo even before the Cold War ended. And they were getting ready for wars with the Southern Hemisphere, which would be in purely imperialistic wars, although, of course, the mass media will never admit it. It'll always be a war for freedom and God and the American way and apple pie and good old mom. But basically, they're all wars to maintain the power of the major corporations and banks.
So the story of the 20th century continues.
Yeah, but as Asia and Africa come online, I see a global brain forming. I didn't invent that metaphor. It's been used by quite a few people. I think as information travels faster and faster and more in more and more directions, that we're going to develop a global system, not necessarily a world government, but some kind of world governance, let's say, a confederation of some sort, where everybody will be fairly equally represented. I know it sounds utopian, but hell, the Constitution sounded utopian, and it worked for a while. I think the European and Canadian and most of the civilized world, I think most of them have gone a long way down the path I think we have to go in order to have a peaceful and prosperous planet. I think you find more of the United States Constitution alive in Europe and Canada than you do in the United States right now. But I think the United States will eventually rediscover the Constitution. It does exist. You can find it in the back of the dictionary. The Tsar hasn't ordered it taken out of the dictionaries yet. Well, that might be the next step. I would say the Scandinavian countries please me more than any others on the planet right now. And France and Germany are moving more and more on that. So even Portugal is moving in that direction. Hell, they legalized abortion in Spain. I think they just legalized marijuana in Portugal. The world is moving toward a saner system, but I think the United States will be the last one to move because the power groups here are so entrenched and so committed to a very reactionary philosophy.
But do you think that the United States as the center, more or less, of the Internet will reap any of those benefits before other countries?
Well, yeah, to some extent, I think the growing skepticism about the government, which, as I pointed out in my book, Everything is Under Control, around 75% of the population doesn't trust the government anymore. I used to feel like a lone eccentric in distrusting the government. Now it turns out I'm part of the majority. 75% of the population doesn't trust the government. I think that's chiefly due to Internet. Because on the Internet, you get hundreds of different viewpoints, whereas in the corporate media, you only get one viewpoint. Or you cover the whole spectrum, as Noam Chomsky likes to say. They give you the whole spectrum from far right to middle of the road. So so you feel you're getting a variety. That's the newspapers. TV doesn't even go that far. They only give you one viewpoint, the far right.
Yeah, I noticed that particular statistic, that it's a 1996 survey showing 3 out of 4 Americans believe the government is basically constantly involved in nefarious activities and conspiracies. Do you think the internet has caused this change?
Well, yeah, mostly, I think, yeah. I mean, the most outrageous charges against the government can be found on the internet. They seldom get into the major media. There was a reporter on the San Jose Mercury News who did a series of articles on the CIA's involvement in the cocaine business, about which there's been at least a dozen books already. And a week later, the San Jose Mercury News printed an editorial saying the stories were inaccurate, and they fired him. He has since written another book about the subject, adding to the vastly growing library about the CIA and cocaine, and he goes around lecturing about it. And I've read a lot of these books. If I was on the jury, I'd vote guilty if the CIA were on trial as a major coke dealer. But you can't get it into the major media.
So this is an example of a conspiracy theory that is still up in the air in terms of the verdict, but you actually believe it to be real and true.
Like I said, if I were on the jury, I'd vote guilty, knowing what I know now. Of course, if I were on the jury, I'd have to listen to the case for the defense, too, and I might change my mind.
Still, conspiracy theory seems to be the thing that you're best known for.
Alas.
How is it that conspiracy theory intrigues you so much?
Well, it's like internet. It forces you to consider alternatives. Well, if you have a book by a conspiracy theorist and accept it as the Holy Writ, you can spend the rest of your life spreading that conspiracy theory and annoying everybody who doesn't believe it and pounding on the table. But by God, look at this. Look at this document right here and all that stuff. But by and large, on internet, if you go into alt.conspiracy, you'll find 80 different conspiracy theories fighting it out among one another. And you're forced to start thinking, do any of these make any sense? Is there one that makes more sense than the others? Are some of them partly true, some of them mostly false? You got to start thinking in non-Aristotelian categories, not just quick true, false, but how much of this is true? Like Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was a bestseller about 20 years ago. I was really shocked when a friend of mine said he found 3 things in it that weren't true, so he knew the whole book was a hoax. My attitude towards that book is like my attitude towards everything else. How much of it is true? Now, is it true? Is it all true? Is it all false? That seems like childish questions to me. The question is, how much of it can be proven to be true, and how much of it is just guesswork or bluff by the authors? It's about the priority of Sion, an affinity group or conspiracy, whichever words you prefer, of French aristocrats and bankers. Such an organization does exist. Whether their explanation of what this organization is up to is true or false, that I think is debatable, but I think they prove the organization exists. And the Church of Mary Magdalene, which is a central part of their conspiracy, that exists. I've even spoken to somebody who's been there. I haven't been there myself yet, so that's hearsay, but still, he's a guy I trust.
So obviously there are things in the book that can be shown to be true.
Yeah, and there are some things in the book I think can be proven pretty clearly to be untrue. And then there's the large class that belongs in what von Neumann called the maybe state, in between true and false. You just don't have enough evidence to make a judgment.
So is that sort of the nut or the crux about conspiracy theory for you, is that it helps keep the mind open?
First of all, I think a lot of conspiracies do go on. I agree with historian Carl Oglesby, a multitude of conspiracies contend in the night. I think it's normal mammalian behavior. On the other hand, conspiracy buffs tend to be somewhere between mildly paranoid and full-blown clinical paranoid, and I don't trust many of them very much. I think the only conspiracy theorists I really take seriously are Buckminster Fuller, Noam Chomsky, and Carl Oglesby, and all the rest of them seem in varying degrees of paranoia.
But you don't feel that it's the whole field is just simply paranoid fantasy?
Absolutely not. The idea that conspiracies don't occur is like saying snow never happens. It's contradicted by all the facts of history. You pick up any book of history and you find they're talking about conspiracies in ancient Rome, conspiracies in Renaissance Italy, conspiracies within the British government in the Elizabethan age. History is largely a history of conspiracies. To claim conspiracies don't exist is it's an article of faith, like the Darwinian idea that there's no intelligence anywhere and everything happened by accident. Or the Christian idea that a guy named Yahweh built the whole universe while living on a cloud a few miles above Israel and sending fire and brimstone down on everybody who infuriated him, or seriously vexed him, I should say.
You distinguish between fungible and non-fungible in relationship to conspiracy theory. Can you explain those terms?
Fungible is a legal term. It's related to the RICO law. Well, it originally started in mercantile law. A product is fungible if every part of it is the same. Like if you're selling corn and it's 90% corn and 10% junk you found in the backyard, it's non-fungible. Gold brick, it looks like it's solid gold, but it's mostly lead. That was a very popular swindle in the 19th century. The theory of fungibility, as I apply it to conspiracy theories, is when people go really bonkers and they say every member of the group is equally evil and they're all involved in the conspiracy and you can't trust any of them, etc. That's the kind of thing that Adolf Hitler taught. And I think those theories are always crazy. Whether they pick on the Jews or the Jesuits or the Freemasons or whoever they pick out, I don't believe in fungible conspiracies. There are degrees of involvement. Is he winning? That's a question they use a lot in the CIA. That means how much does he know about what he's doing? Another useful term to remember is useful idiot. I think that started in British intelligence. A useful idiot is somebody who's working for an intelligence agency but doesn't know it. The theories I find really dangerous are like anti-Semitism, which led to unprecedented horrors in this century and horrors on lesser scales because they had lesser technology throughout the history of Christendom. And I find a lot of feminism to be equally nefarious in implication, although they haven't had enough power to do anything about it. But some of the feminists, when they talk about men, they sound just like Adolf Hitler talking about Jews. It's really scary. The parallel is so damn close. And then there are these theories where all the Freemasons in the world are part of one gigantic conspiracy for the Freemasons to take over everything and run everything. I know too many Freemasons to take that seriously. Freemasons are as miscellaneous a group as the Presbyterians, the plumbers. You find all sorts of people in the Freemasons, and they don't all have the same ideas.
So the way you use the term, it means a kind of absolute blanket generalization about any group?
It's treating a group as homogenous. Homogenous would be a good synonym for fungible.
So you feel we can throw those conspiracies out just based on their fungibility?
On the face of it, everybody has different fingerprints. There are no two brains that are alike. So the idea that you can make generalizations about a large and miscellaneous group and they'll be true about every member of that group, that I think is the most nefarious form of stupidity on the planet.
Well, what's so interesting with that particular form of conspiracy theory is that it contains what you call a strange loop.
Oh, yeah. When you say Bertrand Russell looked into the evidence and concluded that the bankers of Europe consisted 90% of Gentiles and only 10% of Jews, so the Jewish bankers' conspiracy is a myth, and they'll come back with Bertrand Russell was Jewish himself. He changed his name. Then you got to try to prove that Bertrand Russell wasn't Jewish. I actually got into that argument once with somebody about Hugh Hefner. They were convinced he was Jewish. All pornography is created by Jews. Hefner is a pornographer, therefore Hefner is Jewish. I told him he's a Presbyterian. No, he changed his name. Sartre is the only one who's ever commented on this, the delight in being stupid. If you make up your mind you're going to defend a really stupid position, you can get every intelligent person in the room hopping mad. No matter how rational they think they are, they'll eventually get some. They'll get more emotional than you are if you just keep repeating the same stupid things. This is in an essay he wrote called The Anti-Semite and the Jew. And if you're not Jewish and you try to argue with an anti-Semite about his prejudices, the next thing you know, you are yelling and shouting and acting like a fanatic more than he is, because he's saying so many stupid things like, you must be Jewish yourself now. How about you? Well, then your wife is Jewish and she's corrupted you. No, my wife isn't Jewish either. Well, then it was your grandfather. And, you know, when you get into this infinite regress like that, eventually you lose your temper, and then you feel you're as dumb as the guy you're arguing with. Oliver Wendell Holmes called that the hydrostatic principle of controversy. The fools drag everybody down to their own level. Well, Sartre noticed this particularly in anti-Semites. But I've noticed it in all sorts of dogmatic people that hold to strain, like the flat earthers. You get into an argument with a flat earther, and I guarantee you lose your temper before he loses his, because he's enjoying being stupid. He's enjoying making you angry just by sticking to a position which he knows nobody else can believe. That also gives you a feeling of being belonging to the elite. Everybody else is too stupid to see the truth, but I belong to the small group that knows the truth. After you believe that, you're ready when the leader says, here's your cyanide Kool-Aid, have a drink. You go, oh, yeah, sure. And you swallow it all down.
Do you believe that most conspiracy theory or conspiracy theorists are working from a basis of a rational and logical will to determine the facts of a situation? You know, is it scientific, or is this completely some kind of emotional?
Well, it covers the gamut. I like to think of things on a scale of 1 to 10. And I would say some conspiracy theories on a scale from 1 to 10, where 1 is sanity and 10 is total raving lunacy, certifiably insane, as they say, I would say most conspiracy theorists are somewhere above 5 on that scale, and a lot of them have reached 10. But there are some that are pretty close to 1, like Carl Oglesby and a couple of other offbeat historians. Noam Chomsky, Buckminster Fuller, and me. Like I said, everything is under control. Conspiracy theories help make sense out of what otherwise seems a senseless world. That's why so many people believe them, including me sometimes.
How much do you think our own government operates on the basis of conspiracy theory?
Well, I think they worry about conspiracies more than most conspiracy buffs do. I think the government is full of people with guilty consciences, and they're constantly worried we're going to find out what they're really up to. And so they hire more and more spies to spy on us, to find out what we're doing and saying, to see if we're getting to be a real menace to them. And, of course, that means they need more spies to spy on their spies, in case some of their spies are double agents, which is well known in the whole espionage business. So then they need a third order of spies to spy on the second order of spies, and eventually you end up with somebody like J. Edgar Hoover, who uses his power to blackmail the presidents of the United States. Stalin murdered 3 chiefs of the secret police in a row because they found out too much about his own secrets. And nobody murdered J. Edgar Hoover, at least I don't think so. I think he died of natural causes, but he was blackmailing presidents from Roosevelt on. He blackmailed every president who wanted to do something Hoover didn't afford. Like Nixon said in one of the Watergate tapes, well, Hoover performed. He would have scared hell out of them. He's got a file on everybody. He just sensed the envy in Nixon. He wanted a file on everybody, too. He was a rank amateur. Hoover had been at it for 50 years by then. And a lot of the files disappeared the day he died, by the way. Nobody will admit they know what happened to them. Somebody has those files and is still blackmailing people. The government is more afraid of us than we are of them. That's what I always emphasize when I'm talking to radical groups who think their phones are tapped. Well, of course your phone is tapped. If you've done anything to annoy the government, your phone is tapped. They've probably got a mail cover on you, too. But that just shows they're more afraid of you than you are of them. The government doesn't trust the people. And then they wonder why the people don't trust the government. Well, the people don't trust the government because they know we're being spied on all the time. At the last count I heard, there were over 200,000 lawyers working for the federal government. And do you know how much harm a single lawyer can do? A single lawyer can ruin your whole life, you know, just one day in court. 200,000 lawyers devising modifications and amendments to laws and working for Congress and changing, you know. The bureaucracy, the Kafkaesque world they have created, is so onerous, obnoxious, and unbearable to most of the citizenry that everybody bitches about the government at least part of the time. Ergo, the government knows they are not well-loved. And they're wondering how many of us are joining militias or forming revolutionary communist parties like those nuts down in the South or doing something else racist or whatever. So they got to keep spying on us to make sure we're not getting too ornery. And the more the people discover the government is spying on them, the more they distrust the government.
So does that vicious circle end up going anywhere?
Well, it produces what I call rigidicus bureaucraticus, which is where all brain activity ceases. Now, that's due to the snafu principle.
What's the snafu principle?
I was working for an engineering firm, and it was quite clear to me that what the engineers wanted to do and what management wanted to do were two different things, and management never listened to the engineers because they thought they all really wanted to be physicists, and they settled for being engineers because they didn't have enough money to go through postgraduate work and so on, but they really want to go to the moon and do all sorts of impossible things. We're here to see that they do things that make money. Whereas the engineer's attitude is those people are only bean counters and they don't realize how much more money they can make if they let us do the creative things we're thinking about. But the engineers can never get that through because the management was above the engineers. And so the engineers knew what management was thinking, but management didn't know what the engineers were thinking. And then I happened to read Kropotkin's Mutual Aid as a Factor in Evolution, in which he talked about how he became an anarchist. Kropotkin was a prince of the Romanov family, related to the Romanov family.
And to the Tsar, in fact.
Yeah, related to the Tsar, yeah. And he was an amateur scientist, and he made a lot of important discoveries in geology and related sciences. He was sent to do some surveying work in Siberia. He discovered all the laws passed in Moscow for commerce on the rivers were being broken every day because the people who did the commerce on the rivers had discovered that they tried to obey the laws, they couldn't do any business at all. The laws were so complex, intricate, baroque, and czarist in general that you just couldn't obey them. They clogged the system. Nothing could be done. So people just casually disregarded the laws and went about doing their business. And Kropotkin thought that over for a long time and decided that's the way it is in hierarchical organizations. When the people involved in a process aren't making their own game rules, when somebody 1,000 miles away is making the game rules, things are going to be all screwed up unless the people just are far enough away that the guy making the rules can't find out they're not following the rules. If we had a primitive communication system in America today, like they had in Russia in Kropotkin's day, everybody in California who needed medical marijuana would be using it, and Clinton wouldn't have found out about it and sent the feds in to start throwing them in jail. The only way any system survives is if the people who are in the actual situations can make their own rules, and some bureaucrats 1,000 miles away don't know anything about it. And this leads to what I call the burden of nescience. If you're at the bottom of the hierarchy, anything you sense, smell, hear, see, intuit, feel, anything that registers on your nervous system can be reported to those above you only if it suits their prejudices. If it doesn't suit their prejudices, you shouldn't report it to them because, A, they may order a court-martial if you're in the Army. They may order a pink slip if you're working for a corporation. Or they may put you on trial for treason if you really annoy them, or if you live in a Catholic country, you might get called up before the Inquisition and burned at the stake, etc. So as you go up the hierarchy, there's more and more facts that cannot be reported to the next highest level. So at the very top of the pyramid, there's the people who have all the power and don't know anything except what suits their prejudices, because nobody dares to tell them anything they don't want to hear. Meanwhile, those at the bottom of the pyramid have this burden of nescience where they're not supposed to know, think, feel, sense, or in any way make any decisions of their own. They're the ones who are actually running all the machinery and the boats and the factories and everything. And I realized that's why the snafu was coined in the Army. The Army is the most rigidified form of this type of authoritarian structure. Nobody who makes any decisions knows anything about what's actually going on, where the decisions are being carried out, which is why the word snafu was coined in the Army. Situation normal, all fucked up. Well, that's the normal situation in any authoritarian pyramid, which is another reason why power corrupts. It's not just that power brings out the worst in people, but it's that when you're the higher you get, the less you find out about what you're actually supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be governing something, but you can't find out what it is that you're governing. There was an actual case in the Carter regime where a guy predicted when they were holding the hostages in Iran. There was this attempted rescue mission, which was got all botched up. There was one guy in the Carter administration who opposed that and said it couldn't work and explained on military and technological grounds why it was going to be a fiasco. And then they tried it anyway, and it was a fiasco. And guess who got fired? He did. Jimmy Carter just couldn't stand having somebody on his staff who had been proven to be smarter than he was about just one issue, not about everything in general. Jimmy Carter was a pretty smart guy for a president. But just one issue, this guy who was right when Carter was wrong was more than Carter could stand, so he had to leave the government. And so more and more, the people at the top don't know anything about what they're supposed to be controlling.
So you said that modern Americans don't trust the government almost at all. How well do they trust the media?
Well, according to an article in the Christian Science Monitor a couple of years ago, it's pretty much around the same level as distrust of the government. It's around 3 out of 4 Americans don't trust the corporate media anymore. And, of course, nobody trusts Internet, not even the people who use it. All we know about Internet is that you get any opinion you want, and then you're going to have to research a lot of craziness before you find any accurate data. But that's all to the good, because that's the way the universe is constructed anyway. If it wasn't for Aristotle, perhaps we all would have grown up sane, realizing that we're always gambling and we're never sure of anything. And that would make us all a lot more tentative and a lot more careful, and we'd do a lot less stupid things. But Aristotle created this true-false dichotomy, and everybody immediately decided that what they want to believe is true and what the people they don't like want to believe is false, and we've been at war with each other ever since. How's that for a gross oversimplification? Well, I think it's partly true anyway. We're gambling all the time. Nobody has a guarantee that they have the truth.
Do you think that we're now drifting towards a situation that resembles something out of the art of Kafka or Orwell?
I think we've gone beyond Kafka and Orwell. Neither Kafka nor Orwell have ever invented anything like the piss police. That is so surrealistic. I would suspect Salvador Dali faked his death and took over the United States government. There wasn't so much evidence against that hypothesis. Imagine a country built on the idea of individual liberty, where you can't hold a job without giving a urine sample at random intervals, under a constitution that prohibits random searches. You got to go before a magistrate and prove evidence you think that a crime has been committed and why you think so. A cop has to fill out a form and show what crime he thinks was committed, why he thinks this guy committed it, why he thinks evidence might be found in that place. That's the traditional constitutional system. We got random searches of our houses, random searches of our bladders, and people think this is a constitutional democracy. I say it's a czarist government, and anybody who can study history can see it. It has nothing in common with the U.S. Constitution and everything in common with the situation in 19th century Russia.
So back to conspiracy theory. What do you mean when you use the term conspiracy coincidence syndrome?
Actually, I forget where I first encountered that idea, but I was working for Playboy, and somebody submitted an article. I think I was the only editor who voted for publishing the article. And it was about this thing. This guy set out to investigate conspiracy theorists, and he investigated a variety of them, those who thought the Rockefellers ran the government, those who thought the Air Force was engaged in a cover-up of the UFOs, and I forget what others, about 3 others. He found all of them had real incidents that they could demonstrate to his conviction that they weren't making it up, that they had been persecuted, which helped prove that their conspiracy theory must be true, or why would they be persecuted? And I began to think, well, I don't exactly believe in psychokinesis, but I do believe that we program what happens to us a lot more than we're consciously aware of. And it occurred to me that if people who believe widely conflicting conspiracy theories get equally persecuted, they're bringing the persecution down on themselves in some way they don't understand. And that led me into the whole concept of coincidence and synchronicity, and some of it is pretty damn weird. You can't explain it in any rational terms. Well, take Mae Brussel. Her daughter got killed in a car accident. She thought the CIA did that. Now, my attitude is so many kids get killed in car accidents that to immediately jump to the conclusion the CIA did it is kind of premature. If the CIA wanted to shut Mae Brussel up, the obvious thing to do would be to kill her, not her daughter. But then you find things that are really weird, like Kerry Thornley, who believed he was brainwashed by the CIA and was part of the Kennedy assassination, but he couldn't remember all the details. He got held up in his own apartment by a guy who, after pistol whipping him and taking a stereo and a television and a few other things he carted away, he took Kerry's ID with him, too. Now, why did he steal Kerry Thornley's ID? Maybe that's another coincidence, like Mae Brussels' daughter being hit by a car. And the more you look into it, the more mysterious it gets. John Lilly, Dr. John Lilly, who has a background in more sciences than just about anybody I can think of, he has coined the metaphor. He insists it's a metaphor because he doesn't want to be known as a nut. I also call it a metaphor because I still have some faint hope that I won't be known as a nut. The Cosmic Coincidence Control Center, CCCC. It does seem like Cosmic Coincidence Control Center pays special attention to people who pay special attention to it. The more coincidences you look for, the more you find. And the more you look for coincidences, the more you find the really weird ones that seem like synchronicities. As, for example, the 23 theme that runs through several of my books. Yeah. I was giving a lecture in St. Louis. Guy came up after the lecture with his wife, chatted with me a bit, and said, I know how your 23 gimmick works. I said, okay, tell me. He said, it's a neurological grid. You make your readers abnormally conscious of 23s, and they ignore all the other numbers. And I said, congratulations, you found the great magician who makes the grass green. According to Zen Buddhism, you are now enlightened. And then after a while, we decided to go get a pizza. We went to this pizza place. They give you a number while you wait for your pizza. Of course, we got number 23. He said, how do you do it? And I said, I thought you did it that time. I mean, when this kind of thing starts haunting you, you find out that any philosophy you can invent fails to account for it. Synchronicity isn't a theory at all. It's a word that Jung made up and pretended he had a theory to go with it, but in the scientific sense, there is no theory of synchronicity. It's just a label for a phenomenon that tends to occur when you're in depth analysis, Freudian or Jungian, when you do a lot of LSD, or if you do a lot of Oriental meditation, or if you practice Western Kabbalistic magic. And it happens to ordinary people, too, but it happens much more likely if you belong to one of those five groups. If you belong to all five of those groups, the synchronicities accumulate so much that you start to think, to quote Aleister Crowley, the whole universe is an individual dealing of God with your personal soul.
This concludes Side A. Please turn the tape over for Side B.